did get kind of exciting at the airport there for a minute. Kind of got my attention. You know, it's kind of a funny thing. Vince and I do a lot of flying, and he's kind of nervous about flying, and I'm real blasé about it. But when I saw that plane go up in flames, I was real reluctant to get on the next airplane, I want to tell you. And he seemed real calm. I don't understand. I kept saying, aren't you afraid? And he said, no, not especially. Anyway, I am really glad to be here. I may stay or take a train or something. I don't know. I didn't care much for that. It is good to be here. I'd like to thank the committee for asking us to come. It's an honor, I think, to be asked to do this. It always kind of amazes me when somebody calls up and asks if I would come share. It astounds me that somebody is interested in something that I have to say. You know, by the time, just before I got to alcoholics, I was one of those alcoholics at the end that called everybody, you know, on the phone a lot, and nobody was interested in anything I had to say. I never quite gotten over, I'm sober a little over 14 years, and I still haven't gotten over kind of the wonder of the fact that people actually might be interested in something I had to say. If you're new here at Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, I'd like to welcome you. This is a wonderful place to be, you know, I had no idea when I got here what was going to happen in my life. I just knew that I couldn't live anymore the way I'd been living. You know, I hated myself, and I hated the way that I lived, and I knew that I couldn't stop drinking. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in the hopes that I could stop drinking. I just had no idea what great things were in store for me. I drank the first time when I was 13 years old. The reason I drank that particular night is it was offered to me. I was at this party. They were drinking rum and coke, and I said, you bet, and I had a rum and coke. I didn't have any, I don't remember having any feelings one way or the other about drinking or not drinking. I just wanted to fit in with those people, and they were drinking rum and coke, so I drank rum and coke. You know, as long as I can remember, I have not felt comfortable with people. You know, I have not felt able to talk to... The kind of person I am is this. When I'm having a conversation with you, it's hard for me to concentrate while you're talking, because while you're talking, I'm busy thinking about what I'm going to say when you pause. You know what I mean? And so, I used to call that shy. I have always, all of my life, described myself as an extremely shy person. If you're new, I got bad news for you. That's known as self-obsession. You know, you told me that when I came here, and I like shy better. It sounds a lot nicer, but I am self-obsessed. And so I was at this party and feeling, you know, all this, and they were drinking rum and coke, so I drank some rum and coke. And I don't know how much I drank that night, but I drank enough. You know, I drank enough to get drunk, and also to black out, and to pass out, and to wake up in bed the next day with a Marine that I didn't know. It's not what I meant to do. You know, I was 13 years old, and I was a nice girl up until that night, and I felt real bad the next day. I really did. I had a lot of guilt and shame and remorse, and I was terrified that I'd get pregnant, and I just had a lot of bad feelings, and yet I drank again the very next chance I got. I loved what alcohol did for me. The parts of that night that I could remember were great. You know, I remembered drinking that rum and coke and being able to talk to people at that party. I remember dancing. I remember getting up. I'm the kind of dancer who, well, at that time anyway, my story changes as time goes by, but I'm the kind of person who, I'll get on a dance floor if there's 50 other couples already out there dancing. You know, and I remember dancing at this party, and this guy and I were the only ones on the floor there, and I was not the slightest bit self-conscious. I felt perfectly comfortable and at ease, and I knew the next day when I was, you know, mulling things over, that alcohol did that. I mean, there was no question in my mind, if I drink alcohol, I can do things that I can't do. And I drank again every chance I got until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, basically. I don't think that I have ever done anything that could remotely be called social drinking. I have always drank to get drunk. I don't know why you would pick up a drink if you weren't planning to get drunk. I mean, I don't know why you would waste your time with it. Here's the kind of drinker I am. Years after that, I was going to a big political fundraiser with my then husband, and we had paid a lot of money for these tickets. It was at a private home in Beverly Hills, and it was a big, big posh deal. You know, we were all kind of excited about it. And the tickets came in the mail. Excuse me. And on the bottom of the ticket, it said, 2 complimentary glasses of champagne per person. These tickets came like on a Monday or something. The thing was on a Friday, and I looked at those tickets every day, and I mulled that over every day. And about Thursday, I called this house. I cannot believe I did this. I called this house where this thing was being held. I did not identify myself, but I said, I'm coming to your thing there tomorrow night. And I see on these tickets it says two complimentary glasses of champagne. I'm wondering if one, this is like it's not me, you know, if one wanted to purchase additional glasses of champagne, could one do that? And she said, well, no, I'm sorry, we've invited, you know, X number of people, and we bought just that much champagne, and so, no, there would not be any for sale, and I thanked her and hung up, and what I did that night, see, I don't know about you, but I know I can't drink two glasses of champagne and then stop. I know that. And so what I did that night is I went to this thing with my husband, and I stood, you know, behind a pot of palm somewhere with probably a Diet Coke or something in my hand, and I just hung out feeling awkward and ill at ease, and when he said to me, are you ready to go, dear, I went over and I had my two glasses of champagne. I'm not going to walk out on two free glasses of champagne, but I'm not going to have them and have to stop. I had them at a time of the evening when I knew I could go on home and finish out that drunk, which is exactly what I did. That's the kind of drinker I am. It's the kind of drinker I was when I was 13, and it's the kind of drinker I was when I was 30 years old and came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't recognize it then. I didn't, by the way, any kind of insight that I have into my life or my character or whatever, I certainly did not have it when I was living it. And I didn't have it until long after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of thought, after I'd been in AA for a little short while, I kind of thought, well, when you take your inventory, that's when you get it. You know, you suddenly have this great awakening. That has not been my experience. I don't think, this is my opinion. Everything I say is my opinion, by the way, if you're new. It is my opinion that that's not what the inventory is designed for. I think the inventory is designed to get rid of your garbage, you know, your secrets. When I started having insight into Pat, is when I started sponsoring women. That's when I started, you know, I see myself in these women that I, more than I care to, in these women that I sponsor. And that's when I started getting a real clear picture of who I am. Anyway, I graduated from high school. You know, up until that night when I was 13 and took that drink, I was an A student. I went to church on Sunday. I was real involved in a church youth group, and that was real important to me. It was a real important part of my life. I enjoyed it a lot, and I got something out of that, and I got drunk that night. And within 6 months, my life had changed totally, and I didn't even notice it. You know, I'd stopped going to church. I dropped out of that youth group. I was hanging around with a totally different crowd of kids. I was drinking every chance I got. My grades had dropped to C's and D's, and I never even noticed it. You know, it just sort of happened. My parents noticed it, and they did not know that I was drinking, but they knew something was wrong. They sent me away to boarding school for my last couple of years of school. You know, it's one of those schools that's not quite a reform school. Do they still have reform schools? That's an expression you never hear anymore. Anyway, it was like, you know, it was like the step before that. And I graduated, and I went briefly to college, and I got married briefly because this fella asked me one night, you know. That's the truth. I've thought about it over the years, and that's the closest to the truth I can come up with. I must have been 17 when he asked. And now 17 is not over the hill, you know, but I remember feeling this, and I was not, you know, a dog. I mean, I had my share of boyfriends there, and yet I remember feeling this just tremendous sense of relief that this was like, oh, thank God, I don't have to think about that anymore. Now, I hadn't been aware that I had been thinking about it, you know? But I was thrilled that he asked. And so we planned this wedding, and I'll tell you, he was a nice fellow. Matter of fact, I owe him an amend, clearly. I always like to tell this story. You know, when I was about 6 months sober, I ran into him. I hadn't seen him in many years, and my very first thought was, oh, I probably should make amends here. God's just put this man right in my path. I ought to do that. And then my very next thought was, no, I'm not on that step yet, and it's probably that's too soon in my program. I didn't do it. I'd like to toss that in. I didn't do it, and I don't know how to find you now. And I've tried a few times to track him down. I'd like to recommend, if you're new or not so new, and somebody just kind of pops in your life like that, just do it. You know, I really regret that I let that opportunity pass by, and I hope God puts him in my path again someday, because I really would kind of like to get that taken care of. But anyway, we got married, and we planned this big church wedding with hundreds of people. You know, and I knew. Going down the line towards that wedding, you know, the showers and the picking the dress and all that was pretty exciting, you know, but I had this sort of little nagging thing in the back of my head that this was not quite right. See, I always meant to be the kind of person who would grow up and get married and stay married to that person forever. That's what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to just stay married and have a couple kids and, you know, go to the PTA and church and work in the yard on the weekends and just be a regular person. And I knew way in the back of my mind that somehow this wasn't quite right. And yet it was as though I were powerless to stop it. I remember walking down the aisle on my dad's arm thinking, this is a bad idea, but I did it. You know. 6 months later, we were divorced, and I got on with my life. I grew up in Newport Beach in California, and I moved up the road about 60 miles to Los Angeles, and I got a little apartment and a job, and I was 18 years old, and I was really on my own for the first time in my life, and I felt real sophisticated and grown up, and I remember thinking, moving into that apartment, now I can be the person I was meant to be. I don't have those parents and had a husband, and, you know, I'm on my own. I can be the person I was meant to be, and evidently the person I was meant to be was a daily drunk, because that's what happened to me. From the very first day I moved in that apartment, I started drinking daily. From the very first day that there was no control on me, so to speak, from, you know, parents or whatever, I was drinking daily. My first job was for a trucking company, and I drank in these bars where these truck drivers drank. There were about, I don't know, maybe five or six different little places that we sort of rotated amongst, and I loved those bars. I drank in nice places. I drank in dives. I drank in worse places than these truck driver bars, but I liked these bars a lot, these truck driver bars. I one time in L.A. was talking, and I mentioned the name of one of them, and a guy came up to me after the meeting, and he said, I can't believe you drank in that bar. He said, I drank in there for years, and never once did I see a woman in there. Well, that's why I liked it, you know. I was special in there. I got a lot of attention, you know. I liked it just fine. And I was trouble. I wasn't yet legally old enough to drink, and I had a phony ID, of course. And I drank. My days, I worked for that company, that trucking company, for a year. My days were all alike. I'd get up in the morning. Now, I'm young. I've got this tremendous capacity for alcohol. I could drink a lot of these truck drivers under the table, and I thought that was something to be proud of, and I was pleased to prove that to you at the drop of a hat. And so I've got this tremendous capacity for alcohol, but I'm young, and I'm healthy, and I'm not yet suffering from hangovers much. And so it's like nothing could hurt me. You know, I'd get up in the morning, I'd go to work at this company, and at lunchtime we'd go out and we'd have four or five drinks and a hamburger, and then we'd go back, and then at quitting time we'd go back to one of those bars and we'd drink until closing time, and then I'd take one of these truck drivers home with me, and then I'd bounce out of bed the next day and do it all over again, and life was great. You know, if I could stay feeling the way I felt while I was drunk in those truck driver bars, I'd still be drinking. No question about it. But, you know, you can't stay drunk all the time, and things started happening to me. I started having what I've come to know as moments of clarity. I didn't call it that then, but I remember the first one real well. I was sitting at work. I was a secretary at this company, and my desk was like here, and to my right was sort of a picture window that looked out onto the loading dock where these guys would load the trucks, and I was sitting at my desk one morning about 10 in the morning, and I felt somebody looking at me, and I glanced over there out of the corner of my eye, and or four or five of these truck drivers standing out on this dock, all of whom I had known in the biblical sense, you might say, looking at me, talking and laughing. I couldn't hear them because this glass was there, but it was clear that they were talking about me and laughing. It was humiliating. I wanted to die. Remember, I sort of turned my back and acted like I hadn't seen them, you know, and pretended to work and tried not to cry sitting there at my desk, and I just wanted to die. Now, I went out that lunchtime with the guys, and I had four or five drinks and a hamburger, and I went out that afternoon after work with them and drank until quitting time and took somebody home with me, maybe one of those five, maybe somebody else. I don't remember. I took somebody home, though, because that's what I do. You know, that's the way I behave when I drink. I never wanted to be that kind of a person, but it just always seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, I left that job eventually because I couldn't stand looking at those guys in the cold, sober light of day, you know. That's not the reason that I would have given you if you'd asked me why I was changing jobs. If you had asked me, I would have told you I was leaving because there's no room for advancement at this company. I think there's a lot more opportunity at this new job I found, and I believed that, you know, because I needed to believe it. You can't, it was my experience that I just never really looked at any of this stuff very closely. I guess because if you look at it, then you got to do something about it, you know. And so I just never looked at any of it much. I just had another drink and went on. You know, I quit a lot of jobs over the years. When I got to AA, I took the 20 questions, and there's a question on there, have you ever lost a job because of drinking? And I answered that no, because I had never been fired. When I was sober a little longer and got a little more honest, the truth of the matter is I quit every job I ever had because of some behavior that I had done while drinking that was just so humiliating I couldn't face those people anymore. I one time quit a job after an office Christmas party and never went in to clean out my desk because it was so bad what I had done. You know, I knew I couldn't face them. I just called in and said, that's it. And you can send me a check, you can send my stuff or not. Doesn't matter, but I knew I couldn't go back in and look at those people. Here's the kind of drinker I am. One time, one time I went out with my boss and several coworkers, and we were bar hopping around downtown Los Angeles. Now, everybody was drunk. I was not the only one who was drunk. They were all drunk. However, when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. It's safe to say that I don't drink like a lady. If you kind of get the picture here, you know. So I left that job, of course, and moved on, and I just hated myself. I went through these phases. I went through what I call my mariachi phase. I discovered this mariachi band in San Juan Capistrano, which is not exactly around the corner from LA. It's like a 60 or 70 mile drive, and this little bar had this mariachi band, which consisted of maybe 8 or 10 guys. They lived in Tijuana, and they would drive. They played in this bar Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights. And these guys would drive up from Tijuana on Thursday. They'd play there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. And they'd stay in a motel there in San Juan Capistrano. And then Sunday, at the end of their shift, they would drive back to Tijuana, presumably to their wives and many children. I don't know, because they didn't speak English. Even though I knew all of them intimately, I did not know much, as it turned out, about them individually. But I somehow discovered this bar. And I drove down there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for a long time, months. And I'd walk in the bar, and I'd hand the bartender my purse, and he'd put it behind the bar. Everybody knew me. He'd put it behind the bar there and for safekeeping. And at the end of the night, you know, I'd figure out my tab with him, and I would sit there and drink. And they had a little dance floor there that the patrons of the bar, you know, could dance. And at some point during the evening, one of these mariachis, now I was, I don't know, maybe 20, 21, 22 at the most. These guys were all in their 50s. None of them spoke English. I thought they were wonderful. I mean, I was like this groupie to this. I was just fascinated with this. And at some point during the night, one of these musicians would, and I use the term loosely, would put his instrument down and ask me to dance. And I can remember, as though it were yesterday, the feeling that I would have, you know, moving around the dance floor with this guy. My feeling was that everybody else, the other patrons in this bar, were looking at me with some sort of awe and admiration, thinking she must be somebody because she knows the band, you know? I mean, we're talking, this is not a high-class place. About a year or so ago, I had to talk at a meeting not too far from there, and I got down to this meeting, and it was really early. There was no traffic, and I got there much earlier than I thought, and I had some time to kill, and I thought, I'm going to see if I can find that place. It had been years since I had, of course, been there, and my car, like, went right to it, and it was nighttime when I was down there this time, I parked across the street, and I turned the car lights off, and I just sat in the car. The lights were on, you know, a little bit inside. The door was open, and there were people in there, and so I could sort of see into the door. And I sat in the car about 10 or 15 minutes just looking in that door. And, you know, I thought about all the time that I went there, and I couldn't come up with one single happy memory. You know what I mean? Like, not one real good laugh, not one real good happy time. Every memory that I could come up with out of that place was dirty and sordid and embarrassing and humiliating. And yet I drove down there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for months and months and months. You know, that's what my alcoholism does for me. I don't know why I stopped going there. Presumably something even too awful for me happened, and I stopped going there and was off on my next thing. You know, I just don't drink well. I met my after the incident of applying for the job as the stripper, I decided that this actually was kind of a clever way to make. I got the job, and I thought, God, this would be a clever way to make money, and I could get rich. You know, I could work the day job and work the night job, and I kind of had this whole thing. So I started. I quit that day job where they knew that I had done this, and I got another secretarial job, and I started sort of living this double life. I was a secretary during the day, and I'd go in, and I'd be dressed kind of like I am now, you know. And I was pretty quiet by now because I was tired. I wasn't getting a lot of sleep, so I never said much during the day. I just sit at my desk and I did my work, and I wouldn't bother anybody. And they all thought I was pretty demure. And I'd get off at 5 o'clock, and I'd drive down to wherever I was working on my night job. This was in the this really kind of dates me, but it was in the height of go-go dancing. There were at that time some really nice kind of classy bars in Los Angeles that had go-go dancers. I did not work in them. The two main places I worked were called Nick's and the other one was called Joe's, and they were across the street from the Terminal Annex post office in downtown LA. I mean, you don't even have to know LA to kind of appreciate, you know what I mean? And I would get off work and I'd go drive down there and I'm this shy / self-obsessed person I described to you. There, of course, there's no way I can take off most of my clothes and get up and dance in front of you unless I have a drink. And so I would go there and then I'd have a few drinks while I was putting my costume on and then I would go to work. And I saw this really as this like fabulous show business career. I mean, I really did. It was so tacky. I cannot even believe I did it. Now, I worked from 6 till 2. Now, that's a long time. Everybody in this room understands what I'm talking about here. That's a long time to try to maintain the right amount of alcohol in your system to be able to do it, but not so much that you pass out, you know? Obviously, I mean, if you're an alcoholic, there's no way you can do that night after night after night. And often, I overshot the mark. Often, I passed out. Now, fortunately, this was not the kind of a place that it really mattered much. You know, they just sort of drag you off stage and put you in the back room. There were other dancers who would come out and take your place. And, you know, if you could revive yourself later on and come back out, they'd give you thunderous applause. You know, they'd just say, "Please, to see you back." Career. I don't remember why I stopped doing that. You know, something awful, even for me, must have happened. I met my second husband in Nick's one night when I was working, and he was about as unsuitable. You could line up all the guys in Los Angeles to pick a husband for me, and this would be the last one my mother would pick. Let's put it that way, okay? I don't want to suggest that my parents were not happy about this marriage, but it turned out that we were married for 11 years and they never met him. And we lived right there in the same town, so you kind of get a picture there. So there we are, and we lived together for a while and eventually got married, and something started happening. I didn't know what it was then, and I remember, I don't know if it was my first AA meeting, but one of my early AA meetings, I heard somebody say, "Alcohol stopped working for me." Now, I had never heard that phrase before, but I knew immediately when I heard it what it meant, and I knew when it happened to me, and it was about this time. Alcohol stopped working for me. I was still getting drunk. I mean, if you passed me on the street, you would definitely say, "That woman is drunk," but it seemed like no matter how much I drank, I could not turn off my head anymore. You know, I could not get that feeling back that I got when I was 13 at that party, or when I was, you know, 18 or 19 in those truck driver bars. I just couldn't get it back. Occasionally I would briefly, you know, and then it'd be gone again. And I kept drinking a good number of years still working on it, but I never really could recapture it. I started getting arrested, and I didn't much care for that. You know, I'm a nice girl, and I really couldn't believe these things were happening to me. I didn't even get arrested for stuff like drunk driving. I always kind of thought drunk driving had a certain amount of style to it. If you get arrested for drunk driving, you can say, "Well, I wasn't really drunk. I was sort of reckless, you know, but I wasn't really drunk." When you are arrested for common drunk on Main Street downtown in Los Angeles, there is no way to call it anything but what it is. You know, there's just, that is what it is. And that was my first arrest. My second arrest, I'll tell you the kind of person I am. My husband and I were just newly married, or it might even be just before we were married, but we were living together, and I got arrested, and they took me down to jail, and they said, "You can make a phone call," and I remembered that it was Thanksgiving night. I remembered that my husband or fiance, whatever he was at the time, was at a dinner party at his boss's house. So I called the boss's house, and his boss's wife answered the phone, and I said who I was and that I was in jail, and could they please tell him to come. See, it never occurred to me that, and I really was one of those people, you know, when I got here, and you talked about amends, I really said this one time, "Well, I never really hurt anybody but myself," you know, and I believe that. Let's see, where was I? Arrested. So my next arrest was, is that the score, honey?
Yes.
What's the score?
Notre Dame 41, Air Force 27.
Is that a final score?
Final. Fine.
Good. Now we can all relax. He's been very worried about the Notre Dame score, so now I have his undivided attention. He was actually thinking about staying in the room tonight and saying that he wasn't feeling well, you know, or something. But
I could get a tape.
Yeah, that's right. My second arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing. I'm not exactly sure what I did that night, but I think that must have been pretty exciting, you know. My husband was having some difficulty with some of my behavior, you know. We started having these discussions. Now, I should tell you, he drank. I would never have married this man if he didn't drink, you know. But it turned out that he didn't drink quite as much as I did. And my, not so much my drinking, but my behavior, you know, got to be a real topic in our house of conversation. And that was, that coupled with the fact that I was getting scared, you know. I'd always kind of done bizarre things and awakened with strange people, but it was getting worse and it was getting scarier for me. And so I started drinking at home. And I remember thinking to myself, I have this drinking problem under control now. I thought that, of course, because not a lot happens to you when you sit in a rocking chair in your living room and drink. You don't get arrested, you don't wake up with bizarre people, you don't lose your car, and what I did for the next number of years is I would get up in the morning, I'd go to work. It's important to go to work. Everybody knows that alcoholics don't have jobs. See, I'm giving this some thought now. Alcoholics don't have jobs, and the job got real important. My last job, I peaked in my career at about age 23. I was, at about 23 or 24, I was a top-notch legal secretary in Los Angeles. When I was 30 and got sober, I was working as a secretary in a YMCA, typing up little flyers about kids' dance programs. It was not a demanding job, to say the least. People would say to me, why are you working there? You have these great skills. And the reason I was working there is because I could do the job hungover, and always did. I could do it dead drunk, and sometimes did. I could miss Mondays and forget to come back after lunch and still get my little flyers typed, and that's why I work there. But that's not the reason I would have given you. I would have, if you'd asked, people did sometimes, my answer was, do you know what incredible fringe benefits there are for working for YMCA? You can take, I don't know if you all know this, if you work for YMCA, you can take any of their classes for free. You could take tap dancing or yoga or anything for free. Now, of course, I never set foot in the class, but I could have, you know. So I'm working there for all these great fringe benefits. Anyway, my days are all alike. You know, I get up in the morning, I always take a shower. People were telling me in the morning at work that I smelled like scotch, and that troubled me because I was not most mornings drinking before I went to work, and that bothered me a lot. So I took a lot of showers. I have used every deodorant and mouthwash ever invented trying to get rid of the smell of scotch. It did not occur to me just to stop putting scotch in my body and maybe the smell would eventually go away. That was not an option at the time. So I shower and deodorize and mouthwash and gargle and go off to work. And I tried mostly to stay away from people in the mornings because they wouldn't smell me. And I tried to hang on. And lunchtime would come. And then, of course, it's the big decision. Do you drink or not drink? If you drink and go back to work, there's going to be trouble. If you drink and don't go back to work, that's trouble too. I did it both ways, you know. Assuming that I succeeded in not drinking at lunchtime, I would work out the afternoon, I would get off work at 5 o'clock, I would go home, I would walk in the kitchen and I would pick up the bottle of scotch and have a drink. Once I had that first drink, it was like, I'm okay now. You know, I can take my coat off, put on my purple flannel bathrobe, which was my final drinking costume, and get settled in the rocking chair and drink until I passed out. And I did that day after day after day. I played those sad records, you know, over and over. Ray Charles, Born to Lose. That was a great one. I called people on the phone. I mentioned that earlier. You know, I called people and, you know, I never meant to wake you up. I really did. I just always kind of assumed if I'm awake, you're awake, you know. By the time I got sober, at the end of my drinking, the only person... Really, the only number I dialed anymore was my mother's because nobody else would take my calls. You know, people would hear it was me on the other end of the phone and they would just hang up, you know, because they just didn't want to hear from me. And so I'd call my mother and I'd cry and carry on. And, you know, if I don't get anything else out of Alcoholics Anonymous except this one thing, I'm overpaid. I no longer torment my mother like that. You know, I'm so grateful that my mother calls me and she asks me my advice about stuff and... She respects my opinion, and that's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle. You know, I can't believe that the change. I hated myself. I hated my life. I knew that nothing good was ever going to happen to me, and I knew I couldn't stop drinking. I had tried to stop drinking. I am not a stupid woman. You know, maybe if I don't drink so much, I could get my life together. So I won't drink. Maybe even I'm an alcoholic. Well, I'm right. Alcoholics just simply shouldn't drink at all. I know that. Cold turkey, you don't drink. So I tried not to drink, and I couldn't do it. You know, I just couldn't do it. I'd come home from work, and there'd be maybe a half a fifth of scotch sitting there, and I'd say to myself, well, it'd be pretty hard to quit with that open bottle there. I'll just drink this down tonight, and tomorrow there'll be nothing in the house, and then it'll be easier to quit. But I'm an alcoholic, and before the night's out, I got to call the liquor store to deliver some more, and what I would have the next day would be more or less a half a fifth of scotch. And I'd say, well, it'd be pretty hard to quit with this open bottle here tomorrow, and I didn't do that once or twice, and I meant it every time. You know, tomorrow I'll quit. The night that I called Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, there was scotch there. It just didn't matter. You know, it just didn't matter. Incidentally, I didn't always drink scotch. I would drink whatever you had. I like scotch. It was my first choice. There was a period of time where my husband had a friend who used to hang around at our house a lot. He was, as it turned out, an alcoholic, and later came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But at the time, I really didn't like this guy because when he came over, he'd drink a lot of my scotch, you know. And money is always a problem for us, you know. And so I resented this guy a lot. So I started drinking this, it was called VSQ Cornet Brandy. And it was the worst. It was so bad. This guy would not drink it. He said he drank it once at our house, and then when he would come over after that, if that's what was out and that's what I was drinking, he wouldn't drink. I mean, it gave you awful. You were in the bathroom the entire next day. You know, it was just god-awful stuff, and it did the same thing to me as it did to him, but I would drink it if I knew he was coming over just so he would stay away from my stuff, you know. Anyhow, I was drunk one night, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what triggered the notion to call Alcoholics Anonymous that night. I remember dialing information and getting the number and writing it down on a little piece of paper and calling. And a real nice man answered the phone and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol, and I started to cry. And he was so nice. You know, he stayed on the phone a long time and talked to me. He told me all about himself, a lot more than I really cared to know about himself. But he was talking to me, you know, and people weren't talking to me much, and had this real, real soft voice. It was just so soothing. This man is still sober today in my home group, and whenever I hear him at the podium, I just feel sort of calm when he talks, you know, just hearing his voice. He wanted to send some women over to my house. Now, can you think of a worse idea than two women coming? I couldn't think of a worse idea. I said, no, thank you very much. I don't think I'm that bad. He said, that's okay. He seemed to understand. He said, that's okay. You don't have to do that. He said, do you think that you could not take a drink tomorrow? It was a Friday night when I called. He said, do you think you could not take a drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night that's not too far from your house? And I said, yeah, I thought I could do that. And so he gave me the address of a meeting place, and I wrote that down on that piece of paper. And, of course, I continued to drink. And the next day I got up, and I remembered making that phone call, which was sort of amazing because I really was in blackouts a lot. But I remembered making that call, and I remembered enough of it, you know, and I found that little piece of paper where I'd written that address down. Now, it did not seem like quite such a nifty idea in the light of day to go racing off to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you, but it was just sort of there in the back of my mind all day. I could not stop thinking about that meeting, and that night at the dinner table, I heard myself say to my husband, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. He didn't care. You know, we had not been getting along in a long time. There was not peace in our house. We fought all the time. He was gone a lot. He was a compulsive gambler, which actually makes for kind of a nice mix, an alcoholic and a practicing alcoholic, because he was gone a lot at the track and stuff, and I preferred that, you know. It just made my drinking easier, and so we, you know, when he was there, we fought, so he didn't care, you know. I remember I changed clothes several times. You know how we women do sometimes. I remember as I left the bedroom, there was this whole pile of clothes that I had tried and discarded as not being appropriate for the occasion. I mean, think about it. How do you know how to dress for Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, Emily Post is not, you know. The costume that I arrived in that seemed to strike the right note, apparently in my mind, was a pair of rubber thongs, jeans, and a knit top that all the knit had gone out of. I don't know why that. I guess because it was comfortable is probably why I wore it. And so I went off to Alcoholics Anonymous. There were about maybe 300 people at that meeting, and it was in the basement of a church, and in Santa Monica, and you had to park in a parking, like a public parking structure across the street with several levels, you know, where you drive up. And as I drove by the church to get into that parking structure, I could see these people like you. You know, they were happy and dressed nice and kissing and hugging and talking. And I thought, there is no way I can go in there. I thought, well, I'll just go park in this structure, and I can sort of look down and I'll watch them for a while. And so I parked the car and I watched these people for a while, and I wanted to go in, but I just knew that I couldn't. And I thought, well, this church was in the middle of a block, and about two doors down was a Thrifty drugstore. And I thought, I will get out of the car and I'll walk by there. You will think, like you're really thinking about me, you know, you will think that I'm going to the Thrifty drugstore. In fact, I will go to the drugstore. I'll even buy something. I'm going to make this real. I'm going to go in that drugstore and buy something, and that way I can kind of walk by there. And I got out of the car with this whole scenario in my head, and I walked, and somehow I turned down those basement steps and walked into that church. And a man was standing at the door, and he said, "Hi, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." And I shook his hand, and I kind of dashed to the back of the room. And it was like this. They had pillars, you know, and I found a pillar in the back of the room and kind of hovered there, you know. And now it's 8:28 at night. The meeting's going to start at 8:30. I have not had a drink today. I know you don't drink before you go to AA, so I didn't have a drink that day. But I am a daily drunk, and I needed one bad. This is long past the time I get started, you know. And I'm dressed in this ridiculous outfit. I'm sick. I'm shaking. I smell like a goat, you know. I'm going to cry any minute. And this man came up to me and asked me if I was new. And I remember thinking, God, how did he know that? There's a lot of people, you know. And I said, yeah, I was. And he went like that, and about 50 women were standing there with their phone numbers written out on little pieces of paper, handing them to me and saying, "Welcome, and call me anytime." And God, I thought they were so nice. And they found me a seat, and the meeting started. A man by the name of Norm A talked that night. And this guy made me laugh. You know, when this guy was talking, I just felt okay. You know, I felt good for the first time in a long time. The minute his voice stopped, that feeling went right out the window. But while he was talking, what I got, of course, is hope. I didn't even know it. You know, I got the big book that night, and I had this handful of phone numbers, and I went home, and I sat up all night that night, and I read up to the stories, the first part of the big book, cover to cover there, and I thought, this is great. I'm going to go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you say that night, go to a lot of meetings. It seemed to me that every Saturday night would be a lot of meetings. And I didn't drink till Friday. 6 days in a row, I did not have a drink, and I was impressed. I really was. I had not. I'm a daily drunk, and I was real impressed. I remember thinking, and I didn't want to drink. I mean, the obsession was gone. You know, I go through my day and I think, God, this is amazing. I'm not drinking. AA really works. And Friday night, I was struck drunk, and I couldn't believe it. I was sitting in my regular bar, drinking a Diet Pepsi, and for several hours. And the next thing I know, it's as though I came to and there's several empty scotch glasses in front of me. And I don't know how that happened. I remember, I'm an AA, I can't be drunk, you know. But I was, indeed. And of course, I had to finish that drunk out that night. And I went back to that meeting Saturday night. And I raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety again. And I was pretty sure that all 300 people noticed, you know. I tend to think the world revolves right here, you know. I got more phone numbers this second meeting. And one of these women said, you know, Pat, we have found that that this program works a little bit better if you call one of these numbers before you take a drink. And I thanked her for that information and drank a couple more times that week. And I finally called her Wednesday night drunk. And she said, "You seem to be having just a little trouble grasping our program. You might find it helpful to have a sponsor." Now, I didn't know what a sponsor was. But I said, "Okay, would you be my sponsor?" She sounded quite delighted. And she said, "I'd be real happy to. Why don't you meet me early tomorrow night at the meeting and we'll talk about it." Now, tomorrow night's Thursday. That's not meeting night. But I did want to get off on the right foot with this woman, so I said, okay, I'd meet her over there. And she asked me if I had a big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said yes, and she said, bring that with you, and so I did. And I met this woman, and we sat down, and the first thing she did is she opened my book to the front cover, and she handed me a pen and told me to write the date in, and I did that, and she said, "That's your sobriety date." And I remember I thought, geez, I should not have done that in ink. I really did not think stay here. I'm happy to report that's my sobriety date up to this very day, August 28th, 1975, if you're counting. Thank you. I'm impressed. The next thing she did was worse. She took a copy of the LA meeting directory and she started flipping through the pages and circling meetings.
She said, now on Monday night you'll go over here. And she was excited. Tuesday night you'll go here, and Wednesday night there. I could not believe it. I said, I am a married woman. You're out of your mind. I cannot possibly go to a meeting every night. And she said to me, well, maybe you can. Maybe you're right. But if you want me to be your sponsor, this is what I would expect you to do. She said to me, I will never ask you to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I have not done. But if you want what I have, and I assume you do, if you've asked me to be your sponsor, then you're going to have to do what I did to get it. And this is what I did. Now, I did not know this woman. And she said, you know, you're certainly free to go ask somebody else to be your sponsor. There's tons of people in AA. I didn't know this woman any better than any of the rest of them. But I remember thinking, you know, if I say no to this woman, I'm going to lose her. And that made me feel kind of panicked. And so I said, okay, I'll do it. But my husband isn't going to like it. And she said, it doesn't matter. You know, it just matters that you do it. She told me that night also that it didn't matter if I wanted to work these steps. It didn't matter if I believed that they would work. It didn't matter if I did them with a good attitude. It just mattered that I did them. And that seemed pretty stupid to me, but I started going to these meetings every night. And I was right. My husband didn't like it one little bit. You know, for years he knew where to find me, sitting in a purple flannel bathrobe in a rocking chair in the living room. You know, I'm not suggesting I was the perfect wife, but at least he knew where I was. And now I was gone every night. And things were bad. We fought about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I had the saddest life of anybody who ever came here. I really did. I cried at every meeting I went to. You know, we fought. He thought I was coming here to meet guys. Now, I had cheated on him all the years we were married. It was a fairly reasonable, you know, guess on his part. Except I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and nobody here was asking, which I found personally very humiliating. And it also really annoyed me that he was accusing me of something that I wasn't at that very moment doing, you know. And no matter, that it wasn't my choice, I wasn't doing it. I wasn't doing it by God, and I didn't want to be blamed. And so we're having these terrible fights. My life was so sad. I'd get up in the morning, I'd go to work, I'd come home, we'd have dinner, we'd have the fight, I'd get in the car, I would be sobbing hysterically, I'd drive to the meeting, I'd get to the meeting, I would cry. My sponsor made me get to meetings an hour before the meeting started. I would cry for the solid hour. I had to go around and shake everybody's hand in the room. I would cry and say, hi, I'm Pat, and cry, and you'd say, keep coming back, you know. And I'd try to tell you how awful my life was, and you'd say dumb stuff to me like, keep coming back, it gets better day at a time. I have just told you that I am in the worst marriage that has ever existed, and you're saying, keep coming back, it gets better day at a time. It is not getting better. In fact, it is getting worse at my house. And you don't clearly understand my case, but I did keep coming back. One night when I was about 3 months sober, maybe 4 months sober, and I believe that this is the most important night of my sobriety up to and including this very night, I went to my home group meeting and I was crying. And a man there said to me, I used to say an old-timer. He had about 6 months, and, seven maybe. It seemed like an old-timer. And he said, hello, how are you? And I thought he cared, so I started to tell him. I'm crying. You know what my husband said, and then I said, and, you know. And he cut me right off in mid-sentence. He said, I don't want to listen to that garbage. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps you'd feel better. I was crushed. I mean, I'm a newcomer. Why don't you talk to me? Maybe you'd feel better. You know, I couldn't believe this man was talking to me this way. And he said, and there's one over there. And he pointed to this girl on the other side of the room, and he stood there looking at me. And I knew if I did not go talk to this girl, he was going to tell my sponsor. You all understand the problem here. So I went over to talk to this girl. Only so my sponsor would keep talking to me. I remember as I was walking across the floor to get to this girl, thinking to myself, my exact thought was, I do not care if this broad lives or dies. I was not, you know, really trying to carry the message of hope here. I went over there and I stuck my hand out and I said, hi, my name is Pat. And the girl who had 12-stepped her that night brought her to the meeting and said, Pat, I am so glad to see you. This is whatever her name was, and it's her first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were talking on the way over here. She just had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I knew you were the right person to talk to her. You know, I stood there. You know how things flash through your mind real fast? My first thought was, well, I don't have anything to share. It doesn't work. Look at me. You know, I missed there that I was sober. You know, all I could see was poor me, poor me. But I also thought in that split second before I spoke, well, it's not working for me, but it seems to be working, you know, for some of these other people. And if this is her first meeting, I really ought to try to say something positive or encouraging here to this woman. And I opened my mouth and I heard myself say, keep coming back, it gets better a day at a time. I cannot believe it. Talk about hypocritical, you know? I did not talk to this woman very long, I know. I know I didn't give her more than 2 minutes of my time because I'm not going to get out of my head much longer than that. But I talked to her briefly and I turned and I was walking back across this big floor to go back to where I had originally been standing. And it struck me that I was not crying. And that was the first time in the 3 months or whatever it was that I was sober in that period of time, from the time I hit the door of the meeting until the meeting actually started, that I was not crying. And it was one of those real moments where, you know, like it hits you. It's like, God, I'm not crying. What's wrong with this picture, you know? It was clear to me. I mean, it's like God gave me the answer. The reason I was not crying is because for that long, I thought about somebody besides myself. You know, for that long, I tried to say something positive or encouraging to this girl that I didn't even know. For that long, I got out of my own head. It is a fact that when I am thinking about you, I cannot simultaneously be thinking about me, and I feel better every time. You know, there's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that says something to the effect that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as working with another alcoholic. It was true that night when I was 3 months sober and had very little to share, and it's true tonight when I'm 14 years and whatever sober and have a little bit more experience to share. You know, it's a fact. There's no doubt in my mind that the reason I am so comfortable and so happy and so at peace with my life so much of the time is because I sponsor a lot of women. I tell these women that I sponsor to call me in the morning before they go to work every day, and I tell them to do that because it's a good way for them to start their day. To be perfectly honest with you, I have no idea what it does for their day, but it's a great way for me to start my day. See, I take these calls one after the other. I'm getting dressed, I'm doing my makeup, and I'm thinking, you know, these girls are, some of them are new, and some of them are not so new, but they're crazy, and they've got living problems and boyfriend problems and husband problems and illnesses and jobs and stuff, you know, life. And I'm driving to work, and I'm thinking about this one or that one, or how could I help her, or what should I say, or what should I have her do, and I'm all the way to work, and I haven't thought about myself once. It's a great way for me to start my day, you know. It works. It absolutely works for me. To go back, I'm there, and I'm in this, I hate this husband, and you know, I just knew that if I just weren't married to him, my life would be perfect. One night when I was about 10 months sober, I spotted this newcomer guy across the room, and he had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head, and my heart started to pound, you know. I can pick him out of a crowd, you know. I leaped across about 12 rows of chairs to introduce myself, and my sponsor was standing over here and noticed, and beckoned me over and reminded me that I was a married woman. And I said, yeah, but I'm so unhappy. And she said, nonetheless, as long as you are married, I expect you to act and behave like a married woman. I said, fine, I'll get divorced. I hate him anyway. And she said, well, no, we don't make any major moves in our first year of sobriety. See, the sponsors do that to you. You can't win. But I was a woman obsessed. You understand, I'm sure. I knew he was the answer to my prayers. You know, to make a long story short, we had to be together. Now, it was complicated. I'm a married woman. Clearly, we're not going to go to my place. He was a newcomer. He didn't have a place. He didn't have a car either. He had a job, though. I was working at that time as a secretary in a record company in Hollywood, and he was conveniently also working in Hollywood at this porn bookstore. So I arranged at work one day for this other secretary to cover for me, you know, so I could take a long lunch hour, and I went and picked him up at the bookstore, and we drove to a motel on Sunset Boulevard and knew each other, and I drove him back and dropped him off at the bookstore, and I was driving back to work, and it struck me that I was living exactly the way I had always lived. I hadn't changed one single solitary thing, you know. The only thing I hadn't done yet was take a drink, you know, but I hadn't changed. I had sat in these meetings for 10 months, and I heard you say over and over and over again, we have to change our lives or we will drink and die. And I just didn't think it applied to me. And that day I realized that it did. I know that day is the closest day I've been to taking a drink since I've been here. And I was afraid. I really was afraid. And I was afraid to tell my sponsor. And I just really felt bad. I'll tell you something else about that day that I always like to mention too. The woman that covered for me that day at work, you know, I worked for that company a few more months, and then I left and went and got another job. And that woman and I stayed in touch for a while. You know, we'd have lunch once in a while. And then we kind of lost touch for a while. And I heard through another mutual friend that the first woman's husband had developed a drinking problem, and that they had gone to some sort of bizarre church in the hopes that this might heal his alcoholism. And when I heard that, I thought, geez, that's funny. I wonder why they didn't call me, or if not me, at least just call Alcoholics Anonymous directly. I mean, she knows AA works. And then, of course, my next thought was, why would she? I mean, what she saw about Alcoholics Anonymous was that it's a place where people cheat on their spouses. Why would she want to send her husband there, you know? It really made me stop and think, You know, I believe that we have a real obligation here. If we're going to let people know we're sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe there's an obligation to behave in a way that would make the program attractive to, because we never know, you know, who's listening to us or who's watching us. And I've always felt kind of bad about that. I hope that man's okay. You know, I don't know. I've had the opportunity on subsequent jobs to be a much better example of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in fact, had the privilege of helping a couple of coworkers get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I feel a little bit like I've, you know, kind of made amends for that. But, you know, I just hope that man's okay. Anyway, I went to the meeting that night and I told my sponsor what I'd done. And she said to me, you know, Pat, you've learned a real important lesson here. You have learned that you're probably not a woman who could cheat on her husband and stay sober. And that's a good thing to know. You don't ever have to do that again, you know. And you did not have to take a drink this time to find it out. And I've been always grateful for that lesson. You know, I think it is an important thing to know. I hope I don't ever have to, you know, test it again. You laughed. I assume he hopes so too. You know, I had started trying to work these steps. I knew that, I read those steps and I knew right away the ones I couldn't do. 4 and 5. I was pretty sure I could. I knew the first night I think I read the book, I knew what you were looking for in my inventory. I knew that you were looking for my secrets. And I had a couple of big ones, and I knew that I could not share them. The day came, of course, when my sponsor said, I think you should start writing your inventory. And I said, oh, sure. And I thought about those secrets, and I thought, well, I wanted to do it. I mean, I'd been here long enough to see people, you know, doing inventories and stuff and getting better, and I wanted that. I wanted to stay sober, and I wanted what you had. But I knew I couldn't do it. I'd lay in bed at night and I would try to visualize myself saying the words of these secrets out loud to my sponsor, and I knew I couldn't do it. Of course, that's not the fourth step, is it? That's the fifth step. I kind of got a little ahead of myself there. The way I finally did a thorough fourth step is I decided I will write a thorough fourth step. I will write everything down. I will write those secrets down. I will write it all down. I will never, ever, 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 ever read it to anyone. Maybe if I do a thorough fourth step, skip over 5 and go on to 6, maybe there's a way I can stay sober. But maybe if I at least do this step thoroughly, I'll be able to stay sober. And so I wrote everything down. One Thursday night, my sponsor said to me, have you finished your inventory? I said, yes. And she said, come over Tuesday night and read it to me. That's terrible. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, I get to think about it. You know, I knew that I couldn't read those secrets, so I thought, well, she doesn't know what my secrets are. You know, she doesn't know. I will just leave those first two little paragraphs out where I talk about those secrets, and I'll start in the middle of that page where the next thought starts, and I will read everything else. I'll just leave that little tiny bit out. She won't know. I mean, believe me, there's enough other bad stuff in here. She will think I've told her everything. And so I drove over to her house with that intention, and I sat down on her couch, and I pulled out my little notebook, and I kind of put my finger there on my starting paragraph. I did not want to make a mistake and start in the wrong place. And I'm ready to roll there, and she said, wait a minute, before we get started, let's get on our knees and say a little prayer. And we got on our knees, and she said something like, dear God, please help Pat be honest tonight. I could not believe it. You know, I just couldn't believe it. I read the whole thing. It took me longer to read these two little paragraphs than it did pages afterwards, because I carried on and sobbed and, you know, just made a scene over every little word, but I did it. You know, I got it out. When I drove away from her house that night, I felt committed to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time, really committed. I knew that I had done something that night that was impossible for me to do. But somehow, with her help and the example of the other people around me, I had been able to do that. And I really kind of felt like I'd really earned my seat here, you know what I mean? I also felt real exposed. And, you know, I thought, God, what if she goes and gets drunk? I mean, she knows a lot of stuff about me. It turns out she did get drunk. She's sober today, 10 years, over 10 years now, but she did get drunk not too long after that, and nothing ever happened. I've never shared anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, nor do I know anybody who's ever shared anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that has ever come back to hurt me in any way. Never. And I find that to be a real comforting thought. Anyhow, I got another sponsor, and I was a year and a half sober, and this woman was sober a long time, and I wanted what she had, which was happy, joyous sobriety. I did not have that. I still cried at every meeting I went to and thought my life was just so sad and tragic. And this woman said to me, you know, Pat, I've watched you around here for a year and a half, and it seems to me that all you do is whine and complain about this marriage. Why don't you, a day at a time, try to act like a kind and loving wife to this man? It was not an appealing idea. But I didn't have a better idea, I guess. And so I remember I said to her, you know, I don't think this marriage can be saved. I really don't think this marriage can be saved. I just think it's gone too far. And she said, it may very well be that you're right. But how about if a day at a time you just act like a kind and loving wife? And then if you do have to walk away somewhere down the road, maybe you'll be able to do it without any guilt. Because maybe in the meanwhile here you will have made some amends. The word guilt got my attention because I had a lot of it, you know. I had cheated on him so much, and he did not know about most of it, and there didn't seem to be any good way to make amends for that. So I became willing to try to do the stuff that she taught me. She taught me really big stuff like treat him with courtesy. Is that an idea? You know, never would have occurred to me. My first direction was every day when I came home from work, I was to ask him how his day went and listen while he told me. And I was not interested in his day, and I told her that. She said, you have to listen for 10 minutes. And I went in the first day and kind of checked my watch and asked him how his day went. He looked a little surprised that I was inquiring, but he, you know, told me a couple of things about his day. And when 10 minutes were up, I left the room. But I felt a little better driving to the meeting that night, and I didn't understand why for a long, long time. I do today. Of course, the reason I felt better that day, nothing changed. We had a fight that night, you know, before I went to the meeting. But I felt better that day because I was had finally taken my focus off the problem, and I was now working on the solution. And I always feel better. Even if the problem's still there, I always feel a little bit better. And time passed. It always sounds real fast when I'm making a talk, but months passed, close to a year maybe. And one night I was on my knees saying my prayers. And in those days, my prayers were pretty simple. In the morning, I would get on my knees and say, Dear God, please help me stay sober today. Amen. And at night, I'd get on my knees and say, Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today. Amen. I did that because I was told to do it. I believed in God. I've always believed in God, but I certainly did not feel any connection. You know, I just got on my knees and said this prayer and felt nothing, and that was that. This particular night I was on my knees saying that prayer, Dear God, thank you for keeping me sober today, amen, and I started to get up, and it struck me that I was comfortable in that house with that man in that marriage. And it didn't happen that afternoon. It had happened a long time ago, and I missed it. I mean, think about this. This is the most important problem of my life, and I missed when it went away. I could not believe it. I remember I was there on my knees, and I was just astounded that could be so. Of course, the reason that I missed when it went away is because I hadn't been looking at the problem in a long time. You know, I had not looked at that problem in a long time. I'd just been busy marching along in the solution. I was real grateful that night. I thanked God for this feeling that I had. And I said, you know, God, I believe if you mean for me to be married to this man, that I could do that and stay sober and probably have a happy life. It wasn't where I would have chosen to be for the rest of my life, but you taught me here I don't have to worry about the rest of my life, and it was real comfortable that day, you know. Not too long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My first reaction, being the selfish woman I am, is I wish this would have happened when I hated him. See, right away, I think, how is this going to affect me? How am I going to feel? What's this going to do to my life? You know, that's who I am. I would like to tell you differently, but that's who I am. I'm pleased to report that I don't act quite so often on those kind of selfish emotions as I used to. I still have them. I just don't act on them nearly so often. I just kept doing what I was doing. I shared that feeling right away with my sponsor, and I shared it from the podium in my home group right away so everybody would know. You know, I think it's real important to have a home group and a sponsor and people who know who you are inside and out, because I believe that that's the kind of thing that will save your life someday. It certainly has mine. And so I shared that, and I just went on doing what I was doing, you know, just acting like a kind and loving wife. He was sick for a year and a half, and he did die, and it was a hard year and a half. There's no question about it. But it was also, up to that time, the best year and a half of my sobriety. If you're new, it's hard to explain that. You just kind of have to take my word for it. It was certainly the best year and a half of our marriage, by a million miles better than the next best year. You know, it was, and that's because of you, because of alcoholic, because you taught me how to be a kind and loving wife. I was so grateful. When he died, I went down to this little chapel and I made these funeral arrangements. The day of the funeral came and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous showed up. None of those people ever met him, you know, but they were there that day because they figured that I'd probably need him. And I realized that day, sitting in that chapel, that what my sponsor had promised me was true. The guilt was gone. Apparently, a day at a time, somewhere in there, I had made my amends to this man. I was real, real grateful that I had stayed when all of my best judgments said, this marriage cannot be saved. There is no good reason for staying here. I am so grateful that I was willing to listen to somebody else and do it their way. I know today that that there is no way Vince and I are married, as most of you know, and we have a wonderful life together. And I know from my perspective of, you know, from my half of the relationship, at least, there is no way that this could be happening to us if I had not stayed in that marriage and learned how to do this. You know, there's no way. You know, I never, when Vince and I got married, boy, that's jumping right from a funeral to a wedding. Jeez, I really ought to put a little more time in there. There was some time in there. My mother did think we started dating a little soon, but what the heck. You tell me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, what I really have to do here is stay sober. You know, I knew in my heart that we weren't fooling around before he died. So, you know, we started dating and it's the way I always thought it should be. You know, I never dated a friend before, ever. Every husband, every relationship I have ever had began this way. We meet, we go to bed, then we embark on a relationship, or not, as the case may be. And Vince had been my friend since the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was in my home group. He was sober longer than I, and he's somebody that I had heard share. He had heard me share. We knew a lot about each other. You know, I shook his hand 5-6 nights a week at meetings, he was my friend, you know, and we started dating, and eventually we got married, and we had an AA wedding. This will just make you sick if you're new. We got married in the backyard of a friend on the program, and an AA lady played the piano, and an AA fella sang some songs, and some AA women prepared the food. His sponsor gave me away, and my sponsor was Matron of Honor, and 300 of our most intimate AA friends were there, and it was great. You know, it was really great. There were, I mean, our group was there, you know, old-timers and newcomers, and there were some people in that yard that day that I didn't know their names. You know, they were new and Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mother was there that day, and, you know, I felt closer to I'm close to my mother, I always have been, but I felt closer to everybody in that yard than I do to my own mother that day, because you know me, you know, and I know you better than I know my own mother, and better than my mother knows me. You know everything about me. You know what makes me tick. And you know when I'm getting in trouble, and you know how to get me back on track. And I was so grateful that day when I looked around and saw all those people, and you know, it's such a gift. My life is such a gift. I cannot believe the life that I live today. We live in a nice house in a nice neighborhood, and the neighbors seem to think that we're a welcome addition to the neighborhood, which is kind of interesting. No one has ever thought that about me. You know, I just can't believe the way I live today. I'm going to talk about one other thing, and then I'm going to sit down. When I got sober, my other major problem was my relationship with my stepfather. My mother married my stepfather when I was 8 years old. When I was growing up, there was some stuff going on in that house that shouldn't have been going on, and I hated this man with real good reason. And anybody would agree I had good reason to hate him, and I did. I never, of course, ever told anybody about it, and in fact, it was one of my secrets in my inventory. And I thought that once I shared that in my inventory, that would be the end of it, you know, that I could, like, get rid of that hate and get on with my life, except that didn't happen. You know, I shared it, and then, you know, I still hated him, and this man is married to my mother yet today, and I visit them and call my mother once a week on the phone and visit once a month or so, and there he is, you know. And it got real hard. The longer I was sober, the harder it got to go down there and be civil to him and you know, to just act like everything was okay. And I just was thinking about it. The longer I was sober, the more I was thinking about it, the more I was hating him. I just got the problem just like grew with every passing day of my sobriety. And I don't know if this happens to you, but it seems to me like when I'm going through something, every meeting I go to, that's what they're talking about. What I was hearing in every meeting I went to is that resentments will kill alcoholics, maybe especially justifiable resentments, that we must find a way to get rid of these resentments or we will surely drink and die. And that's what I heard. It seemed like the speaker would be looking right dead at me saying it, you know. I was afraid. I really was afraid that I might drink if I didn't do something about it, but I didn't know what to do about it, you know. I was told that I was going to have to make amends to him, and that's crazy. If anybody should be making amends here, he should be making them to me. You're wrong this time. You are wrong this time. And I just dismissed the idea for as long as I could until, you know how we are, the pain gets bad enough, we become willing to reconsider, and I became willing to reconsider. It didn't make any sense to me, though. Why should I make amends to him? I mean, I clearly am the victim here, and I was told that, you know, I was sober about 3 or 4 years, I'm sorry to report, before I got around to this. I was told that, you know, Pat, you made amends to your mother already a long time ago now, you know, for the stuff that I did to my mother, the you know, the grief, the anguish, the worry, the stuff we put our mothers through. And this man was living in the house at the same time I was causing my mother all that grief. Why didn't I just make amends to him for that same stuff? Maybe he was a little concerned too. You know, maybe I ought to just take that sort of same list of things and make amends to him. See, I love my mother, and I'm sorry I caused my mother all that trouble. I really am. I love her. I don't love this man. I hate him. What do I care if he was a little worried? You know, I really did not see the point, but I did not want to drink, and so I became willing to do that. Now I'm ready to rush out there and talk to him, and now everybody in AA is holding me back saying, well, now, wait a minute. You better read, you know, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in the 12 and 12, it talks about what I call difficult amends, you know, where the... what I think of as where they're bad guys too, so to speak. That's a terrible way of putting it, but you get my drift here. It's real specific that our job is to stick to the subject and make amends for what we need to make amends for, and not get off into discussing, you know, their shortcomings. But then my sponsor said, you know, in fact, if you do that, it's like you negate the whole thing and you got to start from scratch. Well, believe you me, I did not want to have to do this twice. So I read that over a lot, you know, until I thought about it and I prayed about it until I thought I could go do that. And I went out and I talked briefly to him, and I kind of said what I had to say, and I left right away because I was afraid that if I stuck around, I might say things that I would regret. And so I left. And I was driving back. My parents lived about 50 miles away from us at the time, and I was driving back home, and I thought, well, these steps don't work because I hate him as much as I ever did. Now I'm really, it's somehow worse because I said these things. It just seems to have compounded the problem. And I went back and talked to my sponsor, and she said, you're going to have to do more. You're going to have to do just like you did with that late husband. A day at a time, you're going to have to act like a kind and loving daughter to this man. And I did not think I could do it, but I didn't want to feel the way I was feeling, and so I became willing to try. The first thing that I did, when I called my mother every week, if he answered the phone, instead of saying, let me talk to Mom, I would say, hello, how are you? Let me talk to Mom. Now, that might not sound like a big deal, but I'll tell you what, the first 30 or 35 times I did it, it was a major deal. I would be sweating when I dialed the phone. I was so uncomfortable talking to this man. Somebody then said to me, you know, Pat, a kind and loving daughter might chat with him a little bit, too. A wretched idea that is. I would think, before I dialed the phone, I would think of two topics of conversation that I thought I could chat with him about. I think of these as generic topics, you know, nothing really to do with me. If I'd seen a movie that week, that was a perfect topic. When the Olympics were in Los Angeles, that was, God, I used that for weeks, you know, it's a great topic. And so I'd call and I'd ask him how he was, and he'd respond, and I'd talk about my two little topics, and he'd respond appropriately, you know, and then I'd ask to talk to my mom, excuse me, to my mom, and, no, it's okay, thanks. And Christmas was coming up that year, this first year that I started doing this, A woman that I barely knew but who had heard me talk a little bit about it said, Pat, you know, a kind and loving daughter would not rush out on Christmas Eve, pick up a shirt, and have the store wrap it. Now, I don't know how this woman knew that I was planning to do this. I had to agree that maybe she was right, and I thought, okay. I remember I went home, and I sat down on the couch, and I said, all right, God, I am willing to get this man something he might like or use or appreciate or whatever. I don't know what it might be. And this man really would be hard to buy for if you like him. He's just a tough person to buy for. So I don't know what it is, God. You're going to have to, I'm willing to do this, but you're going to have to give me some inspiration because I just don't know what it would be. And I sat on the couch and I waited for inspiration to strike and nothing happened. And I waited and waited, and it finally dawned on me that just perhaps there might be some footwork involved here on my part. You know, I don't know about you, but I have never been able to ever, since the day I got sober, get on my knees, ask God to do something, and sit back and wait for it and have anything at all happen. It never happens that way for me. My job, it seems to me, is to get on my knees, ask God for help, and then get up and go do whatever it is that needs doing. And it seems to get done when I do that. So I got up. I thought, well, maybe inspiration would strike here a little sooner if I were in a shopping mall, you know, where stuff is. So I got down to the shopping mall, and I was walking around, and I went in this needlepoint shop, and there's this little deal on the wall to needlepoint, a little saying to needlepoint and frame, you know, and hang on the wall. A little saying about fathers and daughters. A sickening little saying about fathers and daughters. But I cannot do it. I just can't. But I bought it, and I did it. You know, needlepoint for the, you know, women, you know, it takes a lot of time. I put a lot of hours into this little thing, and I did my very nicest work. I never for a moment felt the sentiment involved, I can tell you. But I did my nicest work. I got it framed real nicely. I wrapped it up. I took it over there at Christmas time, and there was a moment, a spiritual experience, in fact, on Christmas Day when he opened that gift. He got a little tear in the corner of his eye, that's all. Just in that split second, here and gone that fast, I knew I was on the right track. I knew in that moment so powerfully that if I was on the right track, and if I kept trying to act like a kind and loving daughter, that somehow God would make this resentment bearable enough that I would not have to drink over it. I did not know how that would be, but I believed beyond a shadow of a doubt in that second, hearing gone that fast, that I was doing the right thing. That was a long time ago. You know, that was a number of years ago. About 3 years ago now, he was in the hospital, and I went down to visit him, and I got up to leave. They announced the visiting hours were over. I got up to leave, and I bent over, and I kissed him on the forehead, and I said, "Goodbye, I love you." And I walked out of this hospital. It was nighttime. It was dark. My car was way on the far end of a huge parking lot, and I walked out to my car, not thinking about much of anything, you know, and I got to the door, and I went to put my key in the door, and it struck me what I'd said up there, that I loved him, and I couldn't believe it. I started to cry, and I couldn't get my key in the door. I could not believe that I had said it, and the fact of the matter is that standing there in the parking lot, I realized it was true. You know, it's the same kind of thing that happened with my late husband. It didn't happen that day in the hospital. It had happened a long time ago, and I missed it. You know, I was so busy in the solution, I missed when the problem went away. I don't know how it is. I cannot explain to you, if you're new, how it is that this happens. All I know is that it has happened. What I feel for him today is a lot of compassion. He's a practicing alcoholic. He was when I was growing up, and he is today. I believe he was doing the best he could. I really do. And I hope he makes this program someday, but I don't think that's any of my business. I do not think he would hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous coming from me, and so I do not try to carry it. I do try to be a good example whenever I am around him of sober living in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I do not try to directly carry the message to him. If you're new here tonight, I hope that you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you that this is the very best thing that has ever happened to me. My life is better today than I ever in my wildest drunken dreams imagined it could be. And if you're new, I hope you stay here long enough for the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous to happen for you. Thank you.